The MSU Symphony Orchestra's next concert is tonight at Wharton Center. Current State's Melissa Benmark spoke with both of the conductors who will lead the concert, starting with MSU Director of Orchestras Kevin Noe. The program begins with Beethoven's Second Symphony.
Well, it's tasty and it's difficult. This is unique, I think, in Beethoven's output. For whatever reason, historically, it has probably been the least performed of the symphonies. I think there's no debate that Beethoven is the great symphonist of all time, and all nine are these sort of cherished things, and so they all get some due. I'm not saying the second never gets played, but compared to something like the fifth or the third or the ninth or even the first, it doesn't get done. Part of it is because I think, well, first of all, part of it is because it's just difficult. It's actually really quite tricky, and because it doesn't wear its grandeur on its sleeve the way the fifth does or something, you know, it might be a little less worth it somehow. It feels like it's not worth so much trouble. It also feels a little stuck in a certain kind of way. I don't mean to sound overly critical of the piece, but when, you know, you think of the First Symphony and it has this wonderful and very famous opening where he's trying to change the rules and I'm going to be bold, you know, and I have less hair on my head and I throw soup at people and, you know, it's got this sort of grit to it. And yet it feels like, you know, it feels like classical music, but something is definitely changing. I think after he'd sort of gotten that proven, there's something in the Second Symphony that feels like a return to classicism, but he sort of can't let it go. So while I think the piece is difficult, I think it's definitely worth it, but I think that you have to listen with a different kind of ear to the Second Symphony. It really is a unique little slot between 1 and 3. Once you hit 3, you know, things start really changing. I mean, it really just runs like horses to the barn after that point. 2 seems like a little classical gem that I think doesn't often get done at the level that it should. So,
One of the critics described it as a writhing serpent that just won't die. Why do you think that might be?
Well, again, I think they must be. Well, did they dislike the piece? And was that
at the time? Yeah.
Oh, at the time. Well, you know, back then, what can you say? I don't know. I don't feel there's anything really particularly gnarly about the thing. But again, it's just tricky. You know, these little gestures that you hear that sound like nothing, it turns out that the execution of these things are really quite difficult. The last movement, for example, this thing is impossibly difficult to play. You know, the poor string players, I feel like taking a fire extinguisher and hosing down their fingers at the end of the exposition each time, you know?
And then something completely different, we get into the Ray Vaughan Williams Fantasy on the Theme of Thomas Tallis, which I'm a little biased on because it happens to be one of my favorite things. But it's unusual in a couple of respects, not the least of which is how the orchestra is set up.
Yeah, this is a piece that's very close to me personally. I'm absolutely madly in love with this work, and I've done it a couple times. It was composed after a period in which Vaughan Williams studied with Ravel for some orchestration help, right? And it's interesting, you know, you think of Ravel, the great orchestrator, and he does all these wonderful colors with the orchestra, makes use of every single instrument, you know, additional percussion. Everybody's making these marvelous sounds, all of which you can hear, much like Debussy. Ravel maybe even took it a little further. And Vaughan Williams, after having this experience with him, then chooses as his first orchestration piece an all-string work with no extra sounds to be found anywhere. And that, in fact, I think is actually its strength, because it is absolutely amazing the level of color and depth that you can get in the hands of a great composer with just strings. Now, the piece, unfortunately, I must say, is often played in a kind of one-sided way. It's just sort of warm, you know, and it's really pretty. And so you think, oh, I just love to hear strings just play, you know. And that's great, but the piece is better than that. And if you really work at it, there is an almost unlimited color palette to be explored. So he takes, for example, the whole string orchestra. So you maybe have 60 people, something like that, on stage, you know, full string section. So you hear the whole orchestra play a lot. He also has an offstage orchestra, which you're alluding to before in terms of the way it's set up. So he has a smaller string subset of about 10 people that are called the Orchestra 2 that are designed to be placed in it somewhere else. So in the Wharton Center, we're putting them up in the balcony as far away from the stage as we can get. So it's a little 10-voice string choir that plays up there. And then he makes use of string quartet on stage, so the principal players within the main string orchestra, they get a chance to play as a quartet, and then he breaks up each one of those, and there are four separate solos. So every possible combination of strings that you get, and each one of those, within their own sort of phylum, uses a lot of different colors to express this. And I find this just a breathtaking piece, because it's interesting that he's done this very modern thing in the way he's approached all these colors and broken it up with a very traditional means, and used this old tune by Thomas Tallis as the way to get this done. And I think the piece is just endlessly fascinating and worth an enormous amount of rehearsal and work to really make it sing. I absolutely love this work.
It's interesting because it's such a passionate work, and yet I have not been able to find really anything that would be an inspiration or something he was thinking about or something that was going on in his life. At least the internet seems somewhat devoid of any information about what was moving him while he was writing this. All we know is that he, as far as I can tell, is that he came back from studying with Ravel and put this together.
Well, you know, I think sometimes that can happen. Sometimes you can start off, I mean, one of these great creators can start off with something that seems like an experiment in color or whatever. You see this in an art museum a lot. You know, you go in and you see a painter and say, oh, I was experimenting with this and that and the other and blah, 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 blah. But then you look at the thing and the final product is this masterwork that you can't believe could have begun with such humble means, you know. I think this is no exception. I mean, I'm sure he also wanted to write a great piece, you know, but maybe he just thought, what can I do with strings? And then he had this idea, well, you know, let's just do this Thomas Tallis thing. Let's see what happens. So, you know, humble means magnificent ends, you know.
We're going to switch gears here and talk to the other conductor for this program.
My name is Matt Forte, and I'm getting my master's in orchestral conducting here at MSU.
And you are conducting?
I am conducting Fountains of Rome by Ottorino Respighi.
And what is it about this piece? It's a very visually descriptive piece. What do you think will pull the audience in?
The interesting thing to me about the piece is not only that it's so colorful, but that it's so literal. Respighi authors a four-paragraph-long description of the piece at the beginning of the score. And he wrote this, I think, before he wrote the piece. And the most amazing thing is that almost every word in this description has a direct musical quotient. So that, for example, in the second section, he talks about mermaids and tritons playing amongst jets of water. You can hear the jets of water.
And the mermaids and the tritons.
Indeed. So it's very appealing in that way.
What have been some of the challenges that you think the players have faced in this piece?
It's kind of elusive for the players because the composite effect of the piece is brilliant, but individual lines are kind of tough to grasp. So you have a bass trombone player, for example, or a tuba player, who rest for the first half of the piece and then play something for 3 minutes that is mind-bogglingly hard and then don't play anymore. Or you have a trumpet player who comes in with just this incredibly difficult lick and then 80 measures of rest, and then another incredibly difficult lick. And so for a player, at first, it can seem somewhat elusive. But again, when you stand in a hall and take in the whole, it's absolutely amazing. And the method and intellect with which Respighi executes these various gestures is absolutely astounding.
That was guest conductor Matt Forte, and before that, MSU Orchestra's conductor Kevin Noe. They spoke with Current State's Melissa Benmark.